The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, dude, that's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Smiley Show. We're joined by Chris Como, a very, very busy man. Chris, yeah, I'm sure many people have seen you on plenty of commercials on Golf Channel with your swing expedition, or I'm sure they've probably gone on Golf Pass and gotten your lessons, or they may have seen you standing behind some PGA Tour pros. So a lot of people know who Chris Como is, and we want to find out a little bit more about Chris today. So I appreciate you coming on, my man.
Thanks for having me, Smiley.
How'd you get started in this whole golf cycle of teaching, and where'd your motivation stem from right from the get-go and all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think early on in my sort of career, or my relationship with golf in general, I was really enamored with just coaching and then some of the swing stuff. And I always found it so interesting how there were so many books written about like golf instruction, and it's probably the most sort of studied sport at a very granular level. And I was like, this is wild. But then also like how many different opinions there were. So I just looked at the whole thing, and I obviously loved playing, but the whole kind of like studying swing and coaching, et cetera. I was like, wow, there's obviously not a consensus, which makes things interesting, right? Cause it's like, okay, there's clearly, maybe sort of gaps in the overall kind of understanding or body of knowledge if, you know, the foremost experts are so sort of apart from each other on their opinions. And when I graduated undergrad, I was like, you know, you have these decisions of like, do I go in this direction or do I go in this direction? And, I was very much in love with the game, and I just sort of decided I wanted to go down the path of trying to be a great coach.
Chris, you know, what's kind of funny is how that, you know, back in the day, it used to be a lot of, let's just say, coaches would put out their own videotapes, or even famous players would put out their swing feels of how they would do things. And this is how a lot of coaches learned or became, you know, enamored in trying to become a coach. Now there's all this data, you know, there's Instagram and all these things. But in the past, it was, you know, videotapes is how a lot of people would learn the game of golf.
Yeah, right. All like a lot of great players would put out, you know, their version of My Way. I had a bunch of videos of Nick Faldo with David Ledbetter over at Valderrama. And they did this whole like, and they did a second one also. But I mean, this is quite a while ago. And it was great. It was awesome. And it was a lot of Nick Faldo's sort of feels, what he was working on, things like that, which I actually think there's still a lot of value in, really looking at a player and what their sort of experience of their swing is, even if it's maybe not air quotes objective, like it's giving some insight to like, you know, how did they experience that particular motion? There's certain things that we can't measure, like in the whole air quotes, you know, new sort of era of measurement world. We're still able to measure a very small percentage of what's happening.
Right.
And I think if you kind of like, I don't know if you remember that old TV show Columbo, if you kind of like sort of play detective and like really kind of listen to things, you can sort of pick up things and somewhat fill in the gaps of stuff. I really feel like as a teacher, one of the more like a really important window for me was like hanging out with Tiger and just kind of hearing his experience of his swing, say back in 2000. So we would look at like a ton of footage of a swing back then. And then just like, how did he experience that? And that was just, you know, super illuminating. So I definitely don't think, I think that sort of window where people had produced kind of their own experience of their game, I still think has a lot of value in today's era of like modern instruction with you know, data and TrackMan and 3D, et cetera.
So you graduate from college and you said you had a decision to make. Were you inspired by a certain coach to get into coaching? And was there somebody that was doing it a different way that made you look at, like you're talking about, these gaps and how there's matchups of things that people can't quite measure? Was there somebody that really pulled the strings on Chris Gumman and said, hey, there's a whole lot to learn here in this?
I think in terms of seeing that this could really be a viable career, you know, I remember being out at Valencia Country Club. It was the year, I guess it had to have been the year that they had the PGA at Riviera.
Yeah.
And then they moved it, the LA, or the, I think it was maybe the Nissan Open at the time. I don't even remember, but they moved it to Valencia for 1 year. And Nick Faldo was out there with Ledbetter, and I was more interested in getting, I mean, I was like a kid, right? I was more interested in getting Ledbetter's autograph than Faldo's autograph.
That's when you know.
Yeah. So, but it's like that whole guard of, you know, Butch and Jim McClain and, you know, Mike Adams. And, you know, there's just so many of them, like, you know, guys like that maybe weren't as like mainstream, but like Jimmy Bauer, like they built like really nice brands and careers for themselves. I say brands, there was no such brand, didn't mean anything back then, but like they built like really nice sort of careers for themselves. And to me, it was like, okay, this could be kind of like a career path. And then I feel like the fact that there wasn't sort of this consensus from a person like me, who's like kind of analytical and saying, you know, is it worth going down a path where you can maybe, you know, contribute, make an impact? The fact that there wasn't a consensus told me that there was opportunity to kind of like, if you worked hard, maybe you could like help push sort of the body knowledge forward in a way. So I wouldn't say from, you know, I would say collectively, the fact that people bickered all the time is actually what was inspiring.
So, So Chris, biomechanics, biomechanics in the game of golf, it seems like this is where you kind of were able to mix golf and the science behind the sport. Who did you hook up with from a biomechanism standpoint to where you were able to be able to kind of get underneath the hood of a car, talking about these professional athletes, and be able to really dive into exactly what these players are doing well and what they could even do better?
Yeah. So the first part of my career, I went down I went and worked for Led for a while. I traveled the country and watched a bunch of different people teach, spent a couple of years following Mac O'Grady doing his thing, Hank Haney. So the first window of my career was like trying to, you know, learn either directly from some of these teachers, or, you know, indirectly in whatever way you could, or watch them teach or whatever. And, I end up in Dallas. Adam Schreiber was a huge like early mentor. I mean, it's still like a really good friend. So I ended up in Dallas, and a friend of mine was doing his PhD in exercise physiology at a local university. And they had this crazy biomechanics lab at the university where they had force plates and, you know, 3D cameras, Vicon cameras. And they were studying, I think they're studying like sitting volleyball and like dance. They weren't doing golf at the time. And, you know, I went there, and the head of the department, Dr. Young Hu Kwon, just developed a friendship with him. And that evolved into me bringing golfers to collect data at the university. And then that evolved into me taking an undergraduate biomechanics class with him. And then that evolved with me eventually to me doing a graduate program with him, where, you know, went and did all the master's degree courses in biomechanics through him. And then we just started like collecting data and publishing papers. And, you know, in my mind, I think sometimes people like make too much of like the air quotes measurement biomechanics world. But like, okay, in my mind, I look at it as like this. It's like, okay, if you're swinging a golf club 100 plus miles an hour and trying to hit a golf ball, you know, whatever, 300 plus yards, it makes sense to understand a little bit about like sort of the physics involved of that. Okay.
Yep.
And that's where it's like, you know, what are the forces, et cetera, and torques that are getting in the club, impact stuff. That's where like launch monitors, TrackMan, things like that. It's like, why wouldn't you want to learn that a bit? And then just like the straightforward physics of it. And then if you're using a human body to do it, why wouldn't you learn a little bit about sort of the constraints of what the human body can do? And that's essentially what biomechanics is. And then from there, it becomes, okay, what tools can you use to measure those things a bit? And that's where you have like force plates and 3D motion,
right, right.
And you know, launch monitors, things like that. But that's all just sort of like measuring what's happening. That doesn't necessarily explain why one guy's really good and another guy's not really good. And that's where there's still kind of like this ongoing, how do you like continue to do research to understand that better? And I think that's going to last well past my lifetime. So that's a never ending thing. But this is where, you know, you put the biomechanics on one bucket, but then it's like, you know, there's the bucket of great teachers who have just figured it out through massive trial and error. Like to me, it's like, I like learning from them because in the trenches, they figured things out. Then there's, you know, spending time around great players who've also figured out in their own sort of way. Now they may not be measuring it, but there's still something that you can tease out of that. So spending, you know, if I'm coaching someone, I'm learning just as much from them as I would say they're learning from me, right?
Yeah.
So it's learning from them. And then your own personal experience of just being in the trenches and just like, you know, that trial and error of just like giving a lesson, having it go well, giving a lesson, not having it go well. I mean, I spent years teaching at a driving range and then at a country club, you know, all populations of golfers. And then I think you squish that together and, you know, you start to just sort of hopefully get better at your craft, which at the day, end of the day is still an art, and you're using some sort of science and measurement to help that art. But at the end of the day, there's so much stuff that you're dealing with that's not perfectly measurable that you are still in that sort of art, somewhat intuitive space. So
was there any data that y'all measured during this period of time when you were with the doctor at that university where there was a form of breakthrough for you where you realized, man, there's so many swing theories of how guys teach where it's just flat out wrong. Like the physics and the science behind it say, this is almost impossible to do. And why are guys coaching this way?
You know, it's okay. This is an interesting thing because there's wrong in terms of doesn't match up with exactly what's being measured. Mm-hmm. But then I think if you take that approach, you throw the baby out with the bathwater and you become dismissive and miss sort of, you know, part of what can help you be a better coach. So
right, okay.
I've really like, my goal is not to be like, I'm right, you're wrong. My goal is to freaking help people play better. Right. That's always been my goal. So from that context, it's like, if there's a coach out there that is known, like you've read a book or whatever, like there's a reason for that. They've had success in some situation. They've had success. So even if like what they're saying exactly doesn't match up with, say, a force plate collect data collection, you know, of a bunch of people, whatever it is, it's like, you can't just be like, oh, well, that's wrong. You gotta be like, okay, well, why did that work? Why did that feel, why did that subjective, you know, sort of cue work with that particular golfer? So I've always been super careful not to throw stuff out. But yeah, I mean, I would say like, if you were to take what maybe coaches have advocated for over time, there's going to be certain things that, like, you know, if you measure like a large population of people, like maybe that average doesn't match that. But who's to say averages are what you want to go for anyway, right?
So that's right.
So I don't think, you know, I would say like I've really never tried to look at it through that lens. But it, you know, in terms of things that have been like big kind of like insights, I just think understanding the basic sort of relationship of like, you know, you start to push in this way or that way on the ground or into mm-hmm. a club, and then it makes your body move, you know, it doesn't make your body move, but like there's that relationship between your body, mm-hmm. you know, contracting in this way and your body moving this way, and then how you move the club. And I just feel like that's all been like tremendous extra layer of detail to understand what goes into like the, you know, how a person moves, essentially.
Well, the first time that I heard the name Chris Coleman, I think the first time a lot of people, or at least the golfing world, heard your name was, of course, when Tiger Woods hired you for the first time. This was in 2014. Is that correct?
Yeah. Is that what it was?
Yeah, so
it's been a big blur.
I was a senior in college. Chris, when you get that phone call, first off, were you expecting it? Did you have a relationship with Tiger at the time? And I guess, how did you guys get set up?
I had a relationship with Noda Begay.
Yeah.
And he had kind of followed my career a bit in Dallas, mm-hmm. and he just felt like we would hit it off. So he facilitated a meeting between us. We had a meeting and we ended up, you know, it was supposed to be kind of like a quick, whatever introduction. We ended up sort of talking golf swing. I had my laptop. We looked at swings and talked golf swing for, I don't know, close to 2 hours.
Man, how nervous were you like going to this meeting?
I was really nervous going into it, but then once we started talking golf swing, it was just like that's sort of like my space, right? So I fell into the zone with it, and we were just like riffing off each other. So it was pretty cool. It was quite fun. So once like that initial nerves sort of like got shaken off, you know, you're just in the flow of it. And then that segued into a second sort of meeting. Yeah.
Well, you realize quickly, Chris, is that Tiger is a golf geek, right? And you're just like, well, okay, I can talk to this guy.
He loves it. He loves it. Yeah.
So yeah. What was the first thing at that time that you noticed with his golf swing that you felt like that you would be able to help him with when you're just looking at where he's swinging at it in 2014? And then you talked about how you are looking back at old videos in 2000. Was he chasing to try to get back to more of how he used to swing the golf club at that time?
I mean, I feel like, you know, 2000 is maybe the best anybody's ever swung a golf club. And definitely the best he's ever swung it for him, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's just so good, right? So, but his body was obviously not the same body. So to me, in my mind, as sort of a rough kind of starting point, it was like, how do we get you to swing as close to that as possible, but in a way that your current body can do? So that in my mind was like always the initial goal. And then obviously, you know, you get audibles thrown at you, or you have to call audibles because you get curveballs thrown at you and things like that.
What was his limitations at the time from his body standpoint? Could he move at all? Like
we started working, like, I mean, he had surgery actually pretty recent, like the first meeting. I don't really think he was hitting golf balls yet. I mean, look, he had already had a lot of surgeries and injuries. So,
You're up against it to try to get him to swing as close to that at 2000.
Well, and to me, when I say as close to that in 2000, I think, you know, my mind, it was more of like what his hands and clubs were doing. Hands and club was doing. And then how do you, cause that to me is like, you know, how he would shape the plane of it and his release pattern and things like that. Could he move his body to sort of facilitate that in a way that wouldn't hurt his body going forward?
Yeah.
So what, it's not so much moving his body and his spine and his pelvis like it was in 2000. That's like, you know, probably like just not on the table, but how do you move the club like as close to back of the day as possible, but in a way that his body could do?
What was some of the first things that y'all worked on? So the first couple lessons when he was able to start swinging the golf club, you had him do what?
The first stuff was trying to get him to have some width back in his swing, as an overall shape thing.
Backswing and downswing?
Backswing mostly. And then see how he'd react to the downswing. I mean, like so much of how I coach is like, how do you start with something simple and see how many, you know, birds can you kill with one sort of cue? So the first thing was just starting with like a general sense of having more width in the backswing. If I remember correctly.
How do you get width in a backswing? Is it by shift, a proper weight shift to where then you just keep your right arm just a little straighter for a little longer? Like how does somebody get width in the backswing, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it would be maybe, you know, depending, like width is a very generic term, right? So it could be width in the wrist. It could be width in the right arm. It could be width in terms of like where the arms are working relative to the body. Like you said, it could be some of the weight shift. You know, if I remember correctly, it was mostly just, you know, trying to get some width in both the wrist and like the right arm and then seeing how the body reacts to that.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's like, it's like you have this picture of, okay, I want, you know, this and this to happen, but let's just start with maybe a sense of like the club having more width and seeing how the body reacts to it. But then some people, you know, this is where you learn a student as you spend more time with them, because some people react more to like body cues, some people react better to like a club cue, some people react better to like their hands. You don't know that until you start to kind of like get into it a little bit with someone.
Yeah, I was the type of player, Chris, when I was getting a lesson from someone, I would have one thought and then I would hit balls and really not talk a whole lot until I really could kind of develop some feels and just some general thoughts that I can communicate with my instructor. Mm. Was Tiger a little bit that way where you would give him something and then it would just be quiet for quite some time until he would be able to give you some feedback where you're just sitting there like, does he like this? Is this good?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's it. So, and you've probably experienced that where you've made a coach feel awkward like that, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's almost, you know, you're just kind of testing him a little bit. It's like how patient can they be with themselves knowing that they give me the right information and let me work through this? Cause I can tell you,
look at you testing coaches.
Well, I mean, I went to a lot, Chris.
You've been messing with these guys the whole time.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things, man. I never was able to talk through things until after I could hit balls for a little bit to where I could kind of develop some feels. I would say later on in my career, I probably didn't have as much of that just overall mindset going into lessons. I was probably taking just I wanted to know how to do everything versus before it was me kind of developing my own feels, which is, I think, one of the big keys of how I kind of lost ownership in my own self along the way. But does that make sense, that question?
Yeah, it does. But so I'm gonna ask you a little bit now. But yeah. So I would say it was probably a mix of things. Like there's times when he would want to understand things a little bit more, like because there were down times also where he couldn't really hit a bunch of balls. So it was like, you know, looking at video and gotcha. Then he would kind of meditate on things and then come back with his own insights. But there's times when, you know, similar to what you're saying, okay, he would hit balls and be quiet. I feel like I'm pretty good. I can handle the silence.
Yeah, you can handle it. You can handle the silence.
But part of it is also I don't look at things as like, did I give someone the right information? I look at working with someone as this like evolving thing. And I'm also, you know, okay with pivoting. So to me, it's like, you know, I've been pretty good about, again, I think it comes from the overall philosophy. It's like, I'm not trying to be right in a situation. I'm just trying to help the person get from point A to point B, and point B being, you know, whatever their goals are type of thing. But so that's interesting. So early on when you would get lessons, you would kind of have like that sort of scenario, but then later on you were kind of more like trying to understand it intellectually. And then like, is that how you would say things shifted a bit?
Yeah.
Which at the end of the day is like, that's not the goal of a good player, is to understand it intellectually, right? The goal is to play good.
The goal is to play good. And I think it was much more of understanding how I can eliminate my thoughts down to like one or two things. Can I simplify it enough to where, hey, that thing that you said, yes, it helps me hit it better, but I can't think about that over the golf ball. So there was a process of figuring out, okay, this works for me over the golf ball and this doesn't. And I want to try to get more into the mindset of thinking about this particular thing and how can we get to where we can just focus on this. And that can be really hard as a coach, right? You see the whole puzzle of how things have to happen, but a player sometimes can only see one feel, and this is what they have to get to. So you're having to connect all of these different dots. It's like playing Jenga, right? And sometimes it can be very difficult, I imagine, as a coach.
Yeah, and then there's even like, what is the feel you can do under pressure? Which, you know, obviously needs some pressure to sort of test that. But that's sort of like the next kind of like version of what you're saying. And then, I mean, I think, and it's like if someone for whatever reason needs to make a pretty big shift in their golf swing. I feel like the timing of things is really important too, where it's like, you know, you want to pick windows like in the season or off season or whatever it is to like to bite off certain things. And then, you know, sometimes like if you have room, you can cycle through stuff where it's like you can make maybe a little bit of a shift in certain parts that you both know aren't going to necessarily translate to like in a tournament. Like as a feel.
Totally.
But then you start to settle in on, okay, everything else is like you're saying, the big puzzle, everything else is a place that fits well. But, how do you now settle in on where it matches to this cue? That's something you feel like you can do like under pressure type of thing.
So Tiger might not be the answer here from 2014, 2017, but so often, or so many players have come and seen you over the years, Chris, where you're constantly giving them advice, you're giving them lessons. Has there been a player, whether it was Tiger or someone else, that has given you advice, or you found that you learned something from that player that you've been able to kind of implement in how you coach players moving forward?
I mean, I'd like to say everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, spending time with Bryson, you know, it was like 5 years or so was amazing. I mean, that was its own crazy kind of rabbit hole to go down with a person. You know, it was interesting with him because we did make this sort of, we worked for 2 years where it was more of like, you know, here's his sort of like, you know, how do you keep him in his personal sweet spot? And, you know, I think he won two or three times. And then during COVID, he was like, man, I want to get more speed. So it became
Wait, this
kind
is
of
meathead
like,
time. This is like meathead.
I worked with him before. So I started working with him in 2018. And, you know, he had won, I don't remember exactly, but I know he'd won
once
two.
Once playoff like, events. I remember
yeah,
that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's like
yeah,
up
yeah,
in Caves Valley.
Right, exactly. And then COVID happens and he's like, and we had talked before that where it's sort of like, okay, because I do a lot of stuff with like, say, you know, a stats person. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's always like, okay, where are the places that someone could, you know, find improvement, get edges type of thing in a realistic way? And how does it fit the overall ecosystem of their game? And, you know, we had started talking and, you know, he felt like hitting it farther was a place that he could get a lot better.
Yeah.
And because he was so straight too off the tee. So now you have some wiggle room where if someone's already kind of like wayward, it's like you don't have wiggle room for gains. I actually did I created this graph with Chris Brody, Mark Brody's son, and it was showing a person's strokes gain potential as they increase club head speed given their angular dispersion off the face. And it was really kind of, it's fun to sort of make a prediction of like, okay, this person can truly get meaningful gain if they get more club head speed, whereas this person, it starts to plateau out and you just bring in too much other stuff and then it's like not worth kind of the squeeze type of thing. But anyway, with Bryson, so, you know, we kind of decided to do that. And then during the whole lockdown, I built a lab at my house in Dallas, and he started working out a bunch and we started to make some swing changes. And I mean, that was such a rabbit hole. And I learned so much from that experience.
Well, he was a really, really straight hitter of the golf ball. I personally just remember him during his time at SMU, how straight he hit it. And you go back and look at old videos of how he used to swing it, and you honestly forget how he used to swing the golf club and how really tight and good it was.
It was great. I mean, he had spent, you know, his whole life working with Mike Shy, and they had built a really, really solid golf swing. So it was a great place to sort of jump off from and try to, you know, in today's era, hitting it far and reasonably straight.
Yeah.
You know, can make you a lot of money, can help you win
totally
in certain environments, like, you know, the US Open, right? It was that week was funny at Wingfoot. I had so many people telling me, oh, he's got to hit a lot of irons off the tee. It's super tight. You know, the rough is so long. He's going to have to really pull back off the tee. And I actually, it's funny, I called Mark Brody and I was like, man, I got this hypothesis. I'm like, I don't think that's right. It seems like it's too narrow. Like they set it up too narrow to where even the straightest hitters aren't going to hit a lot of fairways. And if you take that conceptually to the extreme, it's like if you had a 1 yard fairway, right? Mm-hmm. Like that no one's going to ever hit a fairway. What would your best strategy be?
Get as far down there as you can.
and as high, right? Yeah. So it's all carry. Mm-hmm. And that's like what we went into the week with, which is like, how do you hit it as far on as high of a trajectory as possible? if you do hit a fairway, it is a huge edge. And then if you miss it, you're still like, you know, now you just sort of shift gears to like center of the green, but you're trying to hit in the center of the green with a, you know, a wedge.
Yeah. Well, were all getting some looks that week from players that are playing practice rounds with saying like, oh my God, he's hitting driver on this hole. What is he doing? He's an idiot. What is he thinking? And then
I don't remember if other people were commenting on it. I mean, definitely as the week went on, people were like, oh my God.
You should see the line. Bryson took it 12 or something like that.
Right, right. But I remember beforehand, like who we played the practice rounds with, if people were reacting to it. I think it's one of those things where, you know, it's like until you see it in sort of like its fruition in a score.
Yeah,
people will always probably be like, eh, whatever. And then as soon as you start to see like the score, you're like, oh, damn, that's
so
that's working.
And it did. And you know, being a swing instructor, you're not the only person a part of many of these teams like Bryson, Tiger, and Xander have. It's big, big teams with, you know, they have sports psychologists, they have stats guys. And of course, they got their trainers, they got the short game coaches. For you, Chris, who do you typically like to communicate with other members of the team, like you're talking about with like a Chris Brody who can help you with the stats standpoint to be able to kind of be able to, you know, get the best out of the player?
Yeah. I mean, so like a guy like I would say Chris is kind of like on my team when I'm looking at like where to find edges with a guy. Then there's the stats guy. Like there's, you know, sometimes a player will have a stats guy where it's a bit of like course management stuff or, you know, like these, like the caddy will sometimes like partner with them. But I would say I kind of have like air quotes my internal team.
So that's like, Chris Brody's on. You work with Chris. That's
so he's become a really good friend. He works at Ping. I have a really good relationship with all the Ping guys.
Okay.
So he's just a guy that I'll be like, hey, let's work on this project or whatever. And then we'll kind of partner up to do stuff.
Who is, by the way, that graph that you were talking about that you and Chris worked on as far as what player could really gain the most with based off how straight they already hit it. Can you name some of the players that could make like a huge jump? Did y'all find like certain players in this?
Well, like, I mean, Xander was a good example. His straightness was such where like he creates more clubhead speed. It's like, he's going to get massive strokes gained off the tee. And then actually we were able to actually make it to where his distribution was actually straighter, even though he got more speed. So it was like this massive gain off the tee, right? Kitayama, when we were looking at his, it was like, there's not going to be as much of a gain off of getting more speed. So it was very much a focus on how do you kind of like bring it in. And then once you can bring it in, then you can kind of reevaluate and see if there's a gain with some speed stuff. So, you know, this is where, and then you also got to be so careful with how you create. I mean, there's obviously this thing with speed going on right now, but it's a tricky thing, right? There are a lot of people who've gotten messed up trying to get speed. I believe there's kind of like good ways and not good ways. I call it, you know, clean speed versus dirty speed is like whatever. So, you know, I think when someone starts to mess with, say, the release pattern, I think, especially if they're already a fairly straight hitter, I think that's dangerous. So to me, it's got to be done more with like how, you know, your body moves and things like that. But as soon as I see someone trying to certain things create speed in certain ways, like I can be that, feel like that's super dangerous. But yeah, Kitayama is like, you know, let's focus on bringing it in, you know, not just like, you know, driving is one of those things where it's like, it's, you know, someone could hit 12 out of 14 fairways, which sounds great, but if the two fairways they miss are out of bounds, that's no good, right? So yeah, it's like, you can't look at it as just like, it's got to be like, what is the magnitude of your error? The air quotes, the big miss also, that's a huge part of like what you're trying to kind of like, you know, figure out. So
let's use Xander and Bryson as examples of two players you've worked with who have gone and chased speed while you've worked with them. What were some of the initial things that you learned from the data that both could have done to, or I guess did do to be able to add more speed? Is it more hip turn? Is it more how they use the ground properly? And I assume it had to be a lot of protein in there to be able to put some more mass behind the ball too.
Yeah. I mean, I think both of them, you know, did great stuff in the gym. You know, Xander with David Sundsberg, who's an amazing trainer, which is a huge part of it. And, you know, with Xander is just, you know, moving the club in a slightly different way that I felt like would, you know, allow him to kind of just be freer, you know, in transition on the way down.
In what way was that? What did you have to change for him to be more free?
So he essentially got the club kind of more across to the top, but it was also like not just where it was at the top, but the way it kind of like went into the late part of his backswing. And then, you know, from there, it's like, how does someone resist against that and transition? And then where does that make the club again transition? And then how does that match up to what you think their body is going to do if they're trying to, say, air quotes, hit it harder? And then how does that match up to the different shot shapes they want to hit? So in my mind, it's always kind of like working the problem backwards of like, what does the club need to do through the ball to hit the shot shape they want to hit? Guy like Xander works the ball a bunch. So it's like, how is he going to work the club through the ball to hit a, you know, air quotes, his best version of a fade, air quotes, his best version of a draw? And then what is a backswing that's going to, you know, best set that up to where, you know, if he is starting to move more aggressively because of the work he's doing in the gym and just kind of the way he's maybe loading a little bit differently, what is a backswing that will set up that sort of predicted body motion that you would associate with more speed for that person?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that type of thinking. Kitayama is actually sort of the opposite. We were trying to get him more laid off because, again, of the way he would deliver the club through the ball when he would have more control. So now it's like a backswing that sort of like would fit this through the ball motion that he felt like he controlled the ball better with. You know, why, like, again, just to like kind of like a quick summary, it's like with Xander, we're trying to get the club, you know, more cross, less bow to the top. Kitayama, we're trying to get the club more laid off, more bow to the top, but all because of like how it would match what sort of we felt like were their best ways to sort of move through the ball and deliver the club through the ball for the shot chips they wanted to hit. But yeah, with Xander, like, it was a lot of that stuff to kind of match up with the work he was doing in the gym, the way he was loading his body, and how he would sort of fire everything when he was trying to hit it harder.
Dude, he smashes it now.
He smashes it.
It makes a like a sound now off of the tee, where if I'm just sitting here with my headphones watching, calling it in the booth, it's different, man. It's unbelievable how hard he hits it.
Smashes.
Like 185, just cruising.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's cool. I mean, he works his butt off.
I mean, I know.
He's cool, man. He's a great human being who is so good at golf and loves, and he loves it. He loves the sort of the chase of it.
So how did that all come about? The Schauffeles have typically kind of done everything in house pretty much his entire career. When you got the call from the Schauffeles at that time, was it just about kind of cleaning up some stuff from a technique standpoint, or was it a larger conversation of, hey, we feel like there's another level that Xander can get to, and right now he just isn't quite knocking that door down? Was it kind of a combination of both those things, or was it one particular thing?
It wasn't quite like that. I mean, I've known Xander for a long time. We have a mutual friend named Carter Poole, who I used to coach a long time ago. And so we've been friendly for a long time. And, you know, I've been friendly with his dad for a long time, who I don't know if you've...
It's a vibe. It's a vibe.
Ogre's the best. You should have him on sometime. He's hilarious. So, you know, and I actually did a swing expedition show with him years ago, and with Derek Ueda, his putting coach. He's just got a cool team. It's like it's quite the character of characters. you know, his dad, I think, he built this incredible game, right? Like, he had his process of helping Xander build this incredible game in golf swing. And I think his dad was just kind of phasing out a little bit. It's just like, he's been doing it for a long time. And you know, I think as time went on, Xander was just kind of doing it more on his own. You know, just because his dad's living in Hawaii, living the good life and all that. Right. and I think it was just, you know, someone to kind of bounce some ideas off of. You know, it just started more with like, you know, conversation. We went out to dinner, and then it just sort of like organically evolved from there. So I'm not even sure that there was this formal, like, this is what we're looking for per se. Mm-hmm. I think it was more of a kind of like, hey, you know, doing it on my own. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but, you know, doing it on my own for a bit. Not, I mean, again, his dad, even now his dad still plays a role. So I don't want to say fully on his own, but just where it's kind of phased out. But, you know, might be a good idea to have someone kind of around that we can kind of like, you know, bounce stuff off of. And then it kind of evolves into, you know, the relationship it is now.
Well, how satisfying was it last year for Team Schauffele to be a part of, you know, two major championships? And of course, just all the consistency that he has had. And I know, like, you wouldn't be the first guy to take credit for Xander playing that well, but still, man, you've played such a key part. How cool was that to see him have that much success last year?
Yeah, it was incredible. It was an incredible year. You know, again, he's got an amazing team around him. Everybody just, we all have like a great vibe and communication. So it was fun. It was fun to see a guy work that hard. And I think even the way the year started out last year, where there was just all these sort of near misses, right? Mm-hmm. He was like, he was right there for the players and, you know, Wells Fargo. And just, I mean, he was just in the mix of it so many times. And, you know, it's, it, I remember last year, first part of the year, there starts to become this narrative of like, okay, you know, when's he going to close the tournament, things like that. Yeah. And to me, it's like, what are you going to do when you're leading the players and Scotty kind of does what he does on the side? It's like, at the end of the day, sometimes the answer is just keep doing what you're doing. Right. I mean, it sounds like no one wants to hear that, but it's like, sometimes that is the answer. And that was kind of like, sort of, dude, you're just playing awesome golf. Just keep doing what you're doing. And then he goes on that, you know, that run. So it was cool. That was fun to, it was fun to watch. It was fun to be a part of. It was fun to just sort of, you know, see him kind of, you know, realize those dreams that he's been working so hard at for a long, long time, way before I was ever a part of it. So, you know, and his dad too. I mean, his dad's awesome. And just to watch how happy his family was and all that was really cool.
So we start the year at the Century, building off such a, you know, fantastic year where he went two major championships. And Xander, of course, gets an intercostal strain. If anybody's ever had it in the rib, it sucks. You just feel so awkward. And I imagine Xander was dealing with the same stuff. For you, as a coach, you know, these players, all they want to do is go, go, go. How difficult was it for Xander during all this time to try to slow down and let this thing kind of naturally heal on its own?
It sucks. It sucks. Sucks, right? It just sucks. It sucks. Injury sucks. I mean, you don't get to do kind of work the way you're used to. Sucks. So, yeah. But it's like, this is where, I mean, I've been teaching for, I don't know, 27 years now. Mm-hmm. It's like, just in this game, you got to stay humble, like it giveth and taketh. Right. So it's like I know, like, you get excited for like a year last year. Awesome. But golf is, man, you got to stay humble with golf and just kind of do what you can do on any given day and know that you're going to get thrown curveballs.
Right.
And that's just the way the game is. It's part of the beauty of it. Right. Cause it's like, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. So,
well, he didn't exactly get to start the year the way he wanted to, because, you know, he finally gets healthy. And then the first place that you come back is Bay Hill. That might be the most challenging first tournament back of all time, knowing that this rough is like 4 to 5 inches long. Fairways are tight. You know, it's blowing. The greens are dead. They're so fast. So that's got to be tough too, for not only as a coach, but for the rest of the team, is to try to manage a player like Xander's expectations that are so sky high. But, you know, this is a process of getting back to where you're ramping yourself back up. You know, how would you say the first, you know, 3 weeks have gone for Bay Hill, Players Championship, and now Valspar, where it felt like maybe he was working a little bit on technique and getting the rust off, to where Valspar, you know, he played himself into a contention on Sunday where he finally felt those juices again. And then you saw the stats kind of show up too.
Yeah. So what's the question?
The question would be for you, you know, how difficult was it for, you know, just to manage Xander's expectations during this time, knowing that these golf courses are really hard and knowing that he wanted to win every single time he teed it up?
I don't know. I don't think you do manage expectations. I mean, what are you going to, like, at the end of the day, it's like, he's a competitor, and he's, every time he tees it up, he's going to try to win, even if he's just like playing on a broken leg. So
I love it. I mean,
are you going to ever try to take that away from a person?
No.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, in golf, you're constantly punched to the face. You just kind of, deal with the fact that you're, you know, the game will always whoop your ass. So it's like, whatever, right? But that doesn't change sort of your intention, your expectations. Like, to me, it was more strategically like, dude, don't come back too soon. If you do, now all of a sudden, and you flare it up, you run in the risk of like really, you know, disrupting a stretch of tournaments that are very important to you. So like, it's more of like the strategy, but once you tee it up, it's like, you got to know what you're dealing with, and you're dealing with mm-hmm. like, you know, just a warrior who's going to go out there and fight for every shot. And, you know, even if you do hurt yourself, he's going to still fight for every shot, like very Tiger-esque in that regard. So I don't think you ever try to take that away from someone. You don't try to like air quotes, like lower expectations. You just deal with really high expectations. But I think, you know, it's sort of like, if you were to peel away, what does it mean when you say dealing with expectations? I guess the way I would sort of like put that would be, if you start to bring in the past, whether it be, you know, oh, you know, won the PGA and the British Open last year, you bring in the past in a way that's like into the now that's not really relevant. Yeah. And that's an issue, right? It's like, no, at the end of the day, the reason why you won the PGA and the British Open was like, what can you do right now? Right. What can you do in this moment? So then I think that's the air quotes expert. It's like, okay, get back to what you can do in this moment to get better at the game. And then that's kind of what, you know, shows up in the long run of sort of, you know, the results you want. Plus, it's also what's fun. But if you start bringing in other things, it distracts you from like that sort of like in the moment, what you can do. So I think in that sense, yeah, it's just like, don't, but he's great at that. He's, you know, wakes up each day. And it's like, this is what I can do to get better at the game. So,
well, we're 6 days away for these players to be driving down Magnolia Lane to start their prep for Augusta National and the Masters. I know that's going to be on top of the list for Xander, I'm sure, for the rest of his career, to try to get a green jacket. And I wanted to ask you, as a coach, is there a more frustrating place to coach? Well, you know, you can get on the range and stand behind them, but then you can't go on the golf course. You're outside the rope. So like, if there's something specific you're looking for, especially for a guy like Xander, he's got a lot of people watching him, and it can't be that easy.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, we're all guests at Augusta National. So it's like, it is the way it is. I mean, I know that it's the one tournament where I tend to put on like 10 pounds because I'm not walking the course and I'm eating a bunch of pimento cheeses and egg salad sandwiches all week in the area that they give for the coaches. So, you know, it's my spring bulking week every year.
it's a weird event, man. You're so used to your team walking with you during practice rounds, and then all of a sudden you're just kind of lone wolf, which honestly, for a player, isn't the worst thing in the world sometimes.
Well, you know, look, I mean, like, it's just, it's everybody's got, it's the same for everybody. So at the end of the day, it's like now you could argue is like, is there an element of preparation that knowing you're going to kind of be somewhat on your own that week, or it's going to be maybe different than your routine. Like, you almost want to go into it with that attitude, because it is what it is. Like, you can't change it, and everybody's got to do the same thing. So, I mean, it would be interesting it would be kind of interesting to look at some stats if you were to sort of like define players who have historically big teams or spend a lot of time with their team at a tournament, if that change can be correlated to like their performance in the Masters versus players who maybe don't have a coach, or maybe their coaching scenario is a little bit different where they're not as like engaged in the tournaments. It'd be an interesting stat to run to see if like there was a difference that population of player towards the other population of player. I mean, I don't go to like a tournament every week. So much of like my overall like philosophy is to try to help a person be as autonomous as possible. Yeah. So I don't feel like it's that disruptive, but it is, you know, it is obviously different than other tournaments you go to.
Well, as we head out here, like you said, you are a busy man. You travel a lot. And I did want to ask you this, is how often are you on the road with Swing Expedition where you're filming these videos? Is it very time consuming?
Well, we're right now, we're not filming this. We're going to do maybe another version of it. So we're not doing it right now. So right now it's kind of been a bit slower, but between, you know, I go to Dallas a lot. I have an academy out there, two great coaches, Jack DeMonashad, who's a DOI, and then Ryan Ennis, are the two main teachers out there. And, it's at the Nelson, which is, where they used to have like the Byron Nelson a long time ago.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I have some clients that live in New York that I go visit, fairly regularly. And then I go to, you know, whatever tour events a month. So I'm on the road a fair amount, but I'm actually trying to like, I'm trying to pull that back a little bit. So, but I say that every year. So it's not, you know, it's in theory, not in practice yet.
Well, we appreciate you coming on, and Charlie would be very upset if I didn't ask you this one last question, which is, how do you fix the hi-yah?
The hi-ya. Wow. There's different versions of the hi-ya. Do we have any sort of like, whose hi-ya are we talking about? Is this Charlie's or is your hi-ya?
this guy's hi-ya. When we talking about, I get to the top of the golf swing and it's the, uh-oh.
You know, what are you doing these days? Are you playing these days or where are you at?
Man, not a ton. I'm excited to play soon. My version of the hi-ya is I have a ton of speed that I create, and sometimes the club and the club face and the arms aren't quite matched up, can get a little open in transition as I'm one of, when you look at all the force plates and this and that, you're like, man, there's a ton of speed in here that isn't really being used the right way, because I probably have to slow down a little bit to try to get everything to catch up. So I've always struggled with probably proper wrist mechanics and everything being properly matched up, but that's the chase. Am I right, Chris?
yeah, for sure. I mean, I've seen with better players, I feel like I see a lot of hi-yas when it kind of has some sort of late working under type of thing, but then it becomes like, why is that happening? You know, to me, it's like, it goes back to what we were saying before. It's like, you know, it's a little bit of working the problem backwards. So it's like, okay, what is going on through the ball when the hi-ya happens? And then what's happening, like, you know, on that chain going backwards from there, to maybe, you know, contribute to that.
It's, you know, Charlie like wants me to ask this question, but he also doesn't want me. Oh gosh, here's a video. He doesn't want me to solve it because it makes for really good content.
Oh yeah.
Is that four right? Or so I think this is our fourth hi-ya of the day, bro.
Oh, hi-ya.
Well, we have some video for
we
you
have
watch.
Video.
Oh no. Piling on. Well, if you're ever out in Palm Beach or Dallas, why don't we hit some balls?
Yeah, let's hit some balls. I think we need my own swing expedition in all of this.
We can make a hi-ya episode of the podcast.
There you go. Well, Chris, this has been a lot of fun, man. We appreciate your time. Best of luck, obviously, in your coaching career. We're going to be seeing you on the television like we do with the swing expedition. Hopefully, we'll see something new coming with that. And then maybe me hitting some golf balls soon with you. That'd be a whole lot of fun, too.
That'd be fun. Thanks, Chris. Smiley. Thanks, guys. Buddy. Thanks, Charlie.
Best of luck. See ya.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes. So I'm happy to come on and shoot the